Welcome to The Author Meets the Critics, where today's guest is Bruce Catton, author of the controversial bestseller, The Warlords of Washington. Mr. Catton is prepared to meet two critics face-to-face in a battle about a book. Here's a preview of what they think. First, former editorial writer for Life magazine, Mr. Elliot Janeway.
I think that Bruce Catton is a really fine and unusual man. In his book, he reveals himself to be a genuine idealist with a burning sense of indignation against what should provoke indignation, and with a warm, pulsating passion for democracy. I wish he had called his book The War I Fought on the Home Front. That is the burden of my criticism, I think, of his book.
Now, with an entirely different point of view, is the well-known radio commentator, Arthur Gate.
Well, I think this is a worthwhile book because it shows how democracy suffered during the war at the hands of the dollar-a-year men and the generals.
That's what the critics think, and in a little while, Bruce Catton, the author, will meet his critics, no holds barred. But first, here's a special announcement of interest. The Author Meets the Critics would like to remind you not to forget the disabled veterans this Christmas. Why not give a book to an American soldier, sailor, or marine so that you can bring pleasure to a hospitalized veteran? Not a dilapidated book from the attic, not an old novel in a dusty jacket, but a brand new book. One of the books everyone is talking about, like the books discussed on The Author Meets the Critics. Daily lives of the wounded veterans are narrowed down to white hospital walls, but their minds transcend these walls. They want to keep up with the world they belong to and think about the problems and dramas which absorb all of us. Give them a book that's up to the minute, like Eric Johnston's We're All In It, or Roger Butterfield's colorful story of the American past, or any of the new bestsellers. If you want to do something special for a hospitalized veteran this Christmas, we'd suggest a new book. Later in the program, we'll tell you where you can send such books to show that you remembered not to forget the veteran. And now here's our regular chairman of The Author Meets the Critics, John K. M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. Bruce Catton, veteran newspaper man and also veteran of World War I, spent World War II in embattled Washington working with Donald Nelson, first as assistant director and later as director of information for the War Production Board. His book, called The Warlords of Washington, is a challenging account of the wartime activities of big business. Mr. Catton contends that while Americans were fighting for democracy on distant battlefields, we at home came near losing sight of the democratic goal. Here now, before he tangles with his critics, with a brief summary of his own book, is our guest author, Mr. Bruce Catton.
The point I'm trying to make is that we fought a war for democracy without being smart enough to make democracy itself our principal weapon. I think we did this because we were afraid. Democracy means change. It is a revolutionary force, if there ever was one. And since this war was part of a great world revolution, democracy was the only force that could carry us through. But we handed the conduct of the war over to big industry, as represented by the dollar-a-year group, to big industry and to army brass. And they turned the whole war effort into a gigantic attempt to preserve the status quo. So we haven't yet met the underlying revolutionary challenge. Today we're nervous and confused. We're spending all our time counterpunching with the communists instead of going ahead with a program of our own that would make the communists do the counterpunching. We're the greatest nation on earth, but we're acting like a rich old man who's scared of the dark. And it's getting to be a pretty bad world for timid, rich old men.
Thank you, Mr. Catton. Now, do you disagree with the statement, Mr. Janeway?
Why, I could scarcely disagree with the statement in principle because I believe that, John, I was the first to have made such a statement of intent about the war we were fighting in 1941 in a Life article called Roosevelt versus Hitler, calling attention to the fact or the hope that we were fighting not one war but two. A war on the battlefields, and then a war for men's minds and hearts. I think my criticism of Catton at this point is that perhaps he's faint-hearted, too faint-hearted for an idealist as rugged as I'm sure he is, I don't think that we've lost the war for democracy. I'd say we're, it's probably more true that we're just beginning to fight it.
Mr. Gates.
Well, I think the book is worthwhile because it depicts a situation every American needs to take to heart, this stifling of democracy during the war. I think the book is a much-needed exposé of big business and army control of American war production effort, which centered around the War Production Board. Generally speaking, the big business dollar a year men and the general seemed unconscious of any world revolution. They were committed to winning the war, but that victory was to produce no changes here at home. Now, when the war production goals had been achieved, they opposed the piecemeal reconversion programs. The generals, because they were afraid the people would desert their war effort for the security of civilian production, and the dollar a year men, because they did not want the released small industrial concerns to obtain first chance at peacetime production before big business could hog it. Well, then, as soon as the war ended, because no reconversion plans were in operation, every vested interest marched on Congress to pressure the removal of all controls, and our glorious inflation was the result. Catton tells how we got into this present mess, how we hung the crepe on democracy.
Well, now, do you think that this is Mr. Catton's analysis, Mr. Janeway, and do you agree with it?
No, I don't. I don't think it's either his analysis, nor is it accurate, factual description. First of all, what confuses me about Mr. Catton's book is whether it is, on the one hand, a technical, factual, scientific monograph, such as we badly want, of the problem of how to organize and administer public information during wartime. I think his book, in good part, makes a distinct contribution to an understanding of that problem. May I say, in contradistinction to Mr. Gates' view, that it was because Bruce Catton and his boss, Bob Horton, and later Horton's successor, Palmer Hoyt of the Denver Post, had charge of this function, that, and because they worked under Franklin Roosevelt, under whom I don't think it's fair to say democracy was stifled, it was for precisely that reason that democracy was not stifled, and that it is loose talk to speak now of how democracy was stifled during the war. If Hitler had won, democracy would have been stifled. Conversely, if democracy here had been stifled, I'm satisfied that Hitler had won. It was American democracy and the cross-section of American idealisms personified so nobly by Bruce Catton here, which indeed won the war, which sparked the home front, which produced the stuff, which shipped it overseas, and which shot the stuff off and drove the enemy back.
Mr. Gates.
Mr. Janeway, you sort of take the point of view, the attitude that democracy is on a glorious march to victory, that it has no problems, so to speak, and that it...
No, on the contrary, I say that the point about democracy is that it never wins its fights, it always fights its fights. Its fights are always going on. Why throw up the sponge and say our problems have been too much for us?
Well, I don't think this book throws up the sponge. I think the book actually makes people aware of what was happening, and so many people didn't know what was happening during the war.
Bruce Catton was one of those on the firing line, I think, making certain enemies of mistakes of judgment, misplacing loyalties where...
Such as where, Mr. James?
Donald Nelson.
All right. What do you think Mr. James?
Yes, let's hear your criticism of Donald Nelson.
Well, let me put my criticism of Donald Nelson by way of describing the role Roosevelt visualized for the job that was by far the most important job in this war. We didn't win this war on the battlefields overseas to the extent that we won it in our economy at home. Yes, in the economy at home, which is not perfect, which has problems, and which solves and survives those problems by democratic methods and by democratic debate and by democratic pressuring and counter-pressuring. When Roosevelt envisioned the job of directing the home front, of mobilizing it for this war effort, what he said was, in 1940, 1941, the man who will do this job, who will be the Bernard M. Baruch of this war, will be the man who, because of his opportunity for leadership, will have the first call on the Democratic nomination for president in 1944. Instead, the man who was nominated, far from being the man who did the job, was the man who investigated the job, Harry Truman.
Mr.
Gates. Actually, of course, the man who became the president for the fourth time was Mr. Roosevelt.
That's right. But as you know, Roosevelt, like all commanding, historic, epic figures, talked double talk. And when Roosevelt said he will be the man who will have the first call on the Democratic nomination for president in 1944, he naturally wasn't going to say after his third term election whether he was going to run again for a fourth term. Indeed, he couldn't say whether he would be alive to run. That was his way of speaking of the succession. Because all the politicians, read Ed Flynn's book. Flynn's been on this program, hasn't he?
Yes, that's right.
All the politicians coming into 1944 at the Democratic Convention in Chicago were agreed that the man nominated for vice president to run with Roosevelt in the 1944 campaign would indeed be president.
Well, now, let's bring on our author of the afternoon and ask him to comment on this oblique criticism of Donald Nelson, which Mr. Janeway has made.
I don't mean it to be oblique, John.
Well, it is oblique in the sense that it so far is not documented. Your criticism so far stands up in that Mr. Truman became president because he was the man who investigated the job that Donald Nelson did. But Mr. Catton.
Well, I'm not quite sure what we're arguing about at this point, whether democracy missed a beat during the war or whether I wasn't critical enough of Donald Nelson in my book. I think they're two separate points. I'd like to point out, incidentally, that in the book itself, I made two points where I thought Donald Nelson had made very serious mistakes.
And yet the tenor of your book, Mr. Catton, is one which admires Mr. Nelson quite extravagantly.
I do admire him, but I don't deny that he had clay feet that run all the way up to his knees or farther.
Well, I'd say farther.
That's a matter of opinion, I suppose, but I think his two big mistakes, which counted against him and which cost us a great deal, were first, his failure to take the purchasing power, the procurement power, out of the hands of the military when he had a chance to. And second, his insistence on retaining the system of dollar-a-year men. I think those were two very important steps in the conduct of the war.
That was the basis on which he got the job.
That he would keep the dollar-a-year men in and leave procurement in the hands of the military?
Well, that was the basis. That was the basis on which Lord Beaverbrook persuaded Roosevelt that Nelson would be the fellow with whom not to rock the boat. Well, that Nelson would be a safe appointee.
Then your earlier criticism of Nelson falls flat, because you admit now that Nelson never had a chance to begin with.
Oh, I admit that Nelson never had a chance, not because of any reason other than that Nelson was an opportunist, a shallow man, a man who was willing to take a job on the basis of an executive order that was inherently unworkable because watered down from the blueprint needed to give him the authority to do the job.
Well,
I say therefore that no man who would have taken the job for the sake of getting the job with 2 3/4 strikes on him could have been expected to get the job, nor could be worthy of the faith and the loyalty Bruce Catton, an idealist, reposes in him.
Yeah. You, You call him a shallow man, and yet you say that he was responsible for conducting a really great job in war production. And in addition
I beg your pardon. I didn't say
just
that.
Just a minute, Mr. Gates. Go ahead.
I say many things worth criticizing, Gates, but honestly, criticize me for the things I say which are worth criticizing.
Well, you go on then to show that Nelson had some vision. His reconversion program.
I didn't say that.
I didn't say you said that.
I denied that.
Wait a minute,
Mr.
Gates. Mr. Gates.
Let's have a little time. Nelson had enough vision after the production job was really rolling, and it was a tremendous production job, to think in terms of reconversion.
As I say,
and in that reconversion, he was ahead, or at least on the level with the best minds of the country who backed him up, but because of all the obstructions, we never got around to that reconversion program, and we had instead hit and miss action after the war and inflation dumped in our lap.
Well, Mr. Catton,
I'd like to get back.
Mr. Catton,
I'd like to get back to that question of the executive order. As a matter of fact, if the executive order was faulty, it was not any doing of the president or Lord Beaverbrook. Nelson wrote the executive order himself.
That's right.
When he was given the appointment, he was told to write out his own bill of particulars for the job, giving himself such authorities as he thought he needed. So I remember
the expression on the face of your boss and hero, Bob Horton, when he saw the order Nelson produced. I was there.
This is beginning to sound more and more like the Washington merry-go-round.
But say, honest, John, Gaith is hitting them where they ain't, and I'd like to get back this point he raises, which I think he raises as a new point, not against one I've made. I haven't talked about reconversion up to this point. He raises a point against me.
Inserted reconversion as an indication of Nelson's ability and his foresight, not as the point against you.
By the time the reconversion issue had come up, Nelson had been promising so many priorities to so many sources of production demand. He'd been giving out steel and aluminum the way you give out hat check tickets, so much more than there was production to give out, that he was really ridden out of the play. And I must get back to my earlier point that the reason my criticism of Nelson, as stated through Roosevelt, is not oblique, is that one of the successful jobs of investigation Harry Truman did as senator, which earned him or got him the 1944 vice presidential nomination, was that his criticism got Nelson purged and superseded. Nelson began the war, but he ended it on a slow boat to China.
Well, now, I think that we have dealt with the life and times of Donald Nelson. Could we get back to some other chapters? And I don't care, Mr. Catton, which chapter it is, whether it's Get There First.
But again,
I think that,
John,
might be a good chapter to get to.
I know I'm talking too much, John, but since I am, I may as well plead guilty, and you make the worst of it. But
I will.
I know you will. But my criticism of the book is that I don't think you ever can separate anything in the book from Nelson. Every time you get on to any of the analytical problems involved or any of the other commanding and controversial personalities involved, bang, you're up against Nelson, his frustrations, and his failures again. He hits you on every page.
But Mr. Catton's point of view is that the whole dollar-a-year man setup is wrong, that Donald Nelson was a good man, but the dollar-a-year operation was untenable. Isn't that right, Mr. Catton?
Yes, that's true. And before we do go on, I'd like to get back to one point in my little tilt with Mr. Janeway here on Senator Truman.
Back to Donald Nelson.
Back to Donald Nelson.
Okay, gentlemen.
At the time when Nelson was being bought
I'm not an admirer of Nelson's, just in case there's any confusion at the point.
I've begun to suspect that faintly. At the time when Nelson was being bought that one-way ticket on the slow boat to China, one of the men who was most vigorous in insisting that he be retained was this same Harry Truman.
That's right. That's right.
Maybe you wanted to investigate him again.
Yeah. you know what they say? You know what they say in baseball when a batter speaks of a pitcher against whom he's always able to make two base hits? He says of that picture, "That guy's my cousin." See? Well, Truman, of course, was running for vice president, and as long as Nelson was there, Harry Truman was sure of being in the headlines, hitting two base hits every Monday morning.
Well, you sort of take the attitude and approach the fact that Truman had this all planned out.
Sure.
This, well,
Truman. Harry Truman was an active candidate for vice president for at least 2 years before 1944.
Among other things, Mr. Janeway, you've got a lot of imagination.
Gotta have to fight with you, Gate.
Mr. Gatton?
Truman already had been nominated for the vice presidency 2 months at the time the Nelson showdown came.
Yeah, but Nelson fought, I think you'll remember, he fought a rearguard action against...
Well, could I fight a rearguard action and get back to the whole concept of what about these dollar-a-year men, and why, Mr. Catton, do you feel that should we have a similar crisis, perish forbid, that it would be bad to go back to the same way of handling things that we did in this last war?
It's a little complicated. I'll try to make it as brief as I can. When you get into a war like the last one, or a next one, you're spending perfectly fantastic sums of money. You're going to spend $100, $150 billion in the course of a few years. You can't spend that kind of money without having the most profound and lasting effects on the whole country, economically, socially, and every other way. If you put the spending of it and the supervision of the spending, the setting of all the goals by which the money is spent, into the hands of dollar-a-year men, you are putting the control over the country for a long period to come into the hands of people who will lose if anything in particular in the country is changed.
Mr. Janeway, do
I altogether agree that the dollar-a-year system is a bad system and exposes to temptation these trade association secretaries and corporation vice presidents, all of whom have big offices, four secretaries, tax liabilities, and social insecurity. And when they let these contracts for machine guns and aluminum and new plant, they're worrying about where they're going to get a job that will enable them to make up their tax liabilities after the war. So it's a bad system, and it's high time that this country grew up to the point of realizing that it's cheaper by far in terms of human values and real property values to pay people a going market salary for all work done for the public.
Well, and that's one of the major points in the book with which you do agree.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. But I've never said that I disagree with the book in toto. When I reviewed the book in the Saturday Review, I spent three-quarters of my space telling what was good about the book, where it made worthy contributions. You're not twisting my arm to wring
Gentlemen,
a victory from me. I think Catton's a great fellow, and I want him to go on writing books.
It's time now for summations, and I'm going to ask each one of you to make a one-minute closing statement without interruption. I think that we all realize how tough things were in Washington if we never realized it before. And while you're preparing your statement, here's a special announcement.
More than 2 years have passed since the end of the fighting in World War II, yet thousands of American veterans, men who bore the brunt of battle on so many fronts, men whose blood and sweat made our victory possible, are still, after all this time, in the hospital. Many do not know if and when they can go back to normal living in the outside world. Meantime, it is possible to help these men confined between the cold white walls of hospitals to keep up with the doings of the world. They can keep abreast of the times through their minds. And this means chiefly through books, books on all the current problems, political, economic, international, books about interesting people, novels of human drama, novels, books about sports, about man's behavior, about discovery and travel. All these make windows through which men in hospitals can look out on the world and feel themselves a part of it. Would you like to give these veterans a part of it? Would you like to give these veterans a new window to see through? Would you like to help make them feel a part of the world they fought to save? There's an easy way to do it. And this is a particularly fitting time, too, with Christmas just around the corner. Buy a book, a new book, a book that has general interest and that people are talking about, and send it as a Christmas gift to our veterans. Every veterans hospital has a library. To save you the trouble of finding out for yourself which hospital needs new books, the New York Veterans Administration has agreed to ship the books. All you have to do is choose a new book, one you'd like to read yourself, and send it to the following address. Library Division, Branch Office Number 2, Veterans Administration, 346 Broadway, New York 13.
All right, now, Mr. Janeway, I'm going to give you 1 minute to sum up your views on Mr. Catton's book, The Warlords of Washington, on Mr. Catton and on Mr. Gaith, and anything else you can do in 1 minute.
And I'll trust you to be sure it's 60 seconds sharp.
That's right.
John, I think, I like to think and to hope that the payoff to the country on the great public service you're rendering on this program is that it will establish once and for all a point that when you level criticisms at an author and his book, what you are thereby doing is expressing your appreciation of him and of the contribution he's making to the intellectual and social and political life of the country, not, as Gaith here seems to be accusing me of, not expressing the opposite of your appreciation. I hope that by the debate crystallizing here today, we'll be giving Catton courage and inspiration to go forward to a great and a vigorous journalistic career in which he'll be writing not about second-rate has-beens like Donald M. Nelson, but on the contrary, in which...
On the contrary, Mr. Gaith.
There go my 60 seconds. I want Catton on Catton
right,
in the future.
All right, but that depends of your position. I'll get back to the book. I think it's not a crime to write with ideals, and I think here's a presentation of a point of view and approach that is full of ideals, and if we need anything at the present time, we do need someone writing with ideals, making use of the facts to bring out those ideals. The book goes further than that. It not only presents a picture of what happened during the war and why it happened, it goes into the future and shows that because that happened during the war, we're swimming today and we're in difficulty and hot water. It has something to say about the struggle with communism, the struggle that is going on around the Russians. And because of that approach, I think the book has really made a valuable contribution and that it's well worth reading.
And now, Mr. Catton, for your 1 minute summation.
I will wind up by quoting Sumner Wells, who made a speech last night in Rochester, which is quoted in a United Press story in this morning's paper, which I think is apposite. Mr. Wells is denouncing military control in this country, and he says, "Every major issue of foreign policy is now being decided by the National Security Council, one of the Council's seven members. Of the Council's seven members, one has been a professional soldier throughout his long life of devoted and distinguished service. And of the remaining members, all but one speak for and in the name of the armed services. We have every reason to fear that even though actual war may be averted, the United States will be engaged in a losing fight unless American foreign policy becomes the instrument of a democracy which is quite as dynamic as communism." I think that winds up for me better than anything I could say.
Thank you very much, Mr. Catton. And I'm sorry, gentlemen. The time's up for both the author and the critics. And here's Bob Sherry to tell you what lies ahead on our schedule.
Well, next week, the guest author on The Author Meets the Critics will be Morris Ernst, famous New York lawyer, irrepressible champion of civil liberties, who served President Roosevelt several times as private emissary during the last war. His book, called So Far, So Good, is a kind of anthology about his own adventures and opinions. Be sure to be with us next Sunday to hear Morris Ernst meet his critics face to face. And now back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank Bruce Catton for coming here today to discuss his new book, Warlords of Washington, with several subchapters on Donald Nelson. And to thank you, Elliot Janeway, and you, Arthur Gaith, for joining us. This is John K. M. McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone and directed by Lee Jones and came to you from the RCA Exhibition Hall in Radio City, New York. Thank you.